The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
It's time for the debrief. We're going to look back on some of the biggest stories of the week. I'm joined by Professor of Politics at DCU, Gary Murphy, editor of the journal Investigates, Maria Delaney, and columnist and also of the Communications Clinic, Lorcan Nyan. And you're all welcome to the programme. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks,
do you know the big story that we had the most reaction to during the week was the story about Friedrich's ataxia? And we heard from Craig Cody, who told us about his son, Paddy. Paddy started his junior cert this week. His condition is really deteriorating, and Craig had another son, Rory, who sadly died last September, also of Friedrich's ataxia. And Craig wants access to this drug, Skyclarys, which is available and has been funded in many countries across Europe, but not here. And there's this big debate over whether we should just, regardless of the cost, pay for this drug, which is so desperately needed by these people, or whether we should hold the line. Gary, what's your view on it?
It's a tricky case simply because the National Centre for Pharmaeconomics, which the government relies on in terms of the buying of drugs, as far as I understand it, is not sold on this particular drug. But Mr. Cody and anyone who listened to his extraordinary interview with you, Clare, couldn't but be like heart torn at the desperate situation with the death of his son Rory, and good luck to his other son Paddy doing the junior cert this week, which I'm sure must be a stressful enough event in and of itself. And as a citizen of the state, if it was my son, I'd want the state to pay for it, and I can well imagine why Mr. Cody is the same. Now, the evidence apparently, again, I'm just listening to your show and reading up on it, is seems mixed. Mr. Cody talks the fact that this has made a huge impact on the lives of many people across the globe, and then other people are not so convinced that it and because it's a very expensive drug. But my sympathies are with him, and my view is that the state needs to be looking after its people. And, you know, as a law-abiding taxpayer, I think Mr. Cody deserves the support of the state. No. So my sympathies would be not just with him, but with the fact of making drugs available if they are going to make a difference to any citizen of the state.
We had Pádraig O'Sullivan in as well during the week. He's the Fianna Fáil TD who has been pushing for these drugs for rare diseases to be funded. And he made the point that there's an awful lot of money coming into this country, Maria, from the multinational drug companies. And we had those figures this morning in the Irish Times, which have been filed now, public filings in the United States. And we were talking about, in some cases, over $1 billion coming in here. And we're quibbling over the price of this. Now, I get that an assessment is made on efficacy, but it has been shown to be effective in slowing down the disease for some people.
Yeah, and I suppose when you think about if you have a progressive disease, anything that will stop that disease or slow it down, even if you currently will still have the symptoms, makes a huge life difference for people, especially if you get it before they actually have the symptoms. So you're thinking about long-term people starting it when they're 16, that kind of thing. Like, you do also have to look at, like, I know people all are asking for the government to fund this, but there is a need to push for change, to negotiate prices on an EU bloc. We co-published an investigation by Investigate Europe in 2024, and it looked at the CF drug negotiations, and that's Vertex. And it found that kind of the secret deals negotiating with each country really favours companies with treatment monopolies like this drug for Friedrich's ataxia. And also it favours richer, larger nations. So countries like Ireland miss out. Now, they weren't, because of the secrecy, weren't able to find out how much per patient the CF drugs were costing. But they found that in France, it was 71,000, Italy, 81,000. And then if you look at the poorer countries like Poland, well, this was back in 2022, 109,000, Czechia, 140,000.
So that's extraordinary.
Yeah,
isn't
exactly.
It?
And it's this unfair balance of poorer, smaller countries. I know Poland isn't small, but it would be considered one of the poorer countries losing out, and the richer countries getting a cheaper drug.
Yeah, and we're also the end of the supply chain, aren't we? You know, geographically as well. And then in terms of our size, we're such minnows. I have a clip here of Craig from the programme during the week pleading for access to Skyclarys from Paddy, just to get an idea, Lorcan, before we hear from you, of how desperate Craig is.
I just want this drug for my son Paddy and for everyone else that has, you know, because it is progressing a lot. And I already lost one son, and the boy's mom is no longer in the house. So yeah, look, it's just not right. It's just not right for children to leave them suffer like this. It's just not right.
Della, just to remind you, is Craig's wife and she has Huntington's disease. Lorcan, what's your view on it?
Look, it's just such a desperately sad story, desperately sad interview. How could you not want, even if it's a small increase in the quality of life of a son and even if it's a small chance of that increase, whatever you think of the FC, how would you not want that to happen? You have to look at the system as well, that it can't always just be down to the strength of the advocacy, the strength of the anecdotal evidence that comes forward. You have to look at the system. And when you look at the Irish system for this, we quite obviously over-index on cost effectiveness and under-index on actually approving the drugs and the ability to get the quality of life. I mean, if we look at how we approve the cancer drugs in Ireland, it's quite obvious now, oncologists have been telling us for quite some time, that we have a very low access to the newest cancer drugs.
Well, we had one on this morning. We had Janice Walsh on saying that she is the person who has to stand there and tell the patient, I can't get this for you and I know it will work.
And there have been reports that we have the lowest rates of approval in Western Europe, so that when it comes to the new cancer drugs over the last number of years, there's been maybe 56 new EMA approved cancer drugs and we've only approved a quarter of those. Germany, Switzerland, Italy, Austria, Spain, Portugal, Luxembourg, France, Iceland approve more than we do. So either they're all getting it wrong or we're getting it wrong when it comes to the approval. So you actually have to look at the cost effectiveness of it. But we appear to be over-indexing just on the value. Because, look, and I don't blame the department of the HSE or the department within the HSE that's doing this, because they're doing the best job they can in the metrics
they're
given. Well,
that's what they would say, that their job is to mind the budget, you know, and to work within that budget.
And therefore, I think we need a shift in the government approach to this, which is saying, yes, we need to look for value, but that's not the only thing we need to be looking at. And if we are a relatively wealthy country, and if we are a country that has to make decisions on where we spend our money, maybe we should say, look, even if it is a balance of saying, look, we might be overpaying a bit or we're not 100% sure of the efficacy of this, or look, maybe one in two of these drugs will fall through, let's go to the European average and let's just take the risk of funding this because it could have a big impact. So we're slow to approve them in the first place. We take about 2 years, which is too long. And then we are also less likely to reimburse them when it happens. And ultimately, governments make choices. And the advantages we're going to get as a country and globally from AI and from the advances in tech, the only advantages we're going to see is in healthcare. I think we know that. AI isn't great, but there's going to be advances in healthcare. So should we not be positioning ourselves to get the maximum advantage of those rather than being slow movers?
Well, we have to figure it out, because we're getting more and more new and better cancer drugs all of the time, as Janice Walsh was telling us this morning. Also the advantages in obesity medication. We have got to figure this out, Gary. Do you agree?
Oh, I do agree. I would echo Larkin's point about the slowness of the system. I mean, the health, the HSE and the Department of Health, the whole health infrastructure is an enormous bureaucracy. I tend to think it works well when patients are actually in the system. Getting into the system takes time, as we all know, and we would all have had our own experiences. But to go to this particular case, Paddy is like in his mid-teens. There is a real urgency here, and especially with the progressive nature of the disease. We can't afford to be waiting around for years. And look, I talked to you many times over the years, Claire, about waste in the system, not in health, but in the Irish governmental system. And I mean, for the amount of money that this is costing, I think pretty much everyone's sympathies in the country will be with Mr. Cody and his son and his wife.
I take Gary's point on that once you get into the system, the idea is that once you're in there, it's relatively good. But we are now falling behind when it comes to the access to drugs, particularly in the public system. Like Dr. Michael McCarthy from UCG has been really strong on this, saying when patients come into him now who have cancer, the first question he asks is, do you have private health insurance or public? Because that massively now changes the access to the newest drugs that they're going to have, because we are so slow and because of public reimbursement. And then even within that, we then just don't approve elements of drugs. So it's no longer the saying that once you're in the system, you're definitely getting the best access to the drugs, which I do think we need to be very, very careful about. And then even wider than that, look, we spend about 3 billion every year on drugs, which is a lot of money. But like the VAT cut that the government approved, which is a choice, is worth about 700 million every year, the hospitality VAT cut from the last budget. So like, this is all about choices. We're not here saying give everybody what they want all the time. We know you need to make hard choices. But wider than this, the government can make a choice on drugs that says, do you know what? We will go for it. Once it's EMA approved, we will say, you know what, we'll get the best possible deal at the European level, but we want to be first movers and we want to be at the cutting edge when it comes to drugs, rather than laggards, because we're a little bit obsessed maybe coming out of the crash with value for money.
Yeah, and it's often rare diseases that end up falling behind, because these rare disease drugs obviously can only benefit a smaller number of people. They cost more. And I suppose one thing that's not talked about too much is the huge impact on people when they have to campaign like this. I actually was before a journalist, I was a patient campaigner, and I was part of a group that we were campaigning for better treatment for, it was a rare disease as well. And the impact personally and like even physically and emotionally on that, on me and my family, was immense. And like, I just felt, I feel so sorry and heartbroken when I, again and again, I talk to people, I interview people on this, and they have to put their lives out there. They have to detail personal experiences that they don't want everyone to know. And the impact of that, like long term, is really heartbreaking. And that the government keeps having people to go on the radio, go on.
Craig made that point as well, that's really tough, especially when you have a boy sitting in his junior cert on Wednesday. And then we had Elaine Pollard on the programme, whose son Oisin is almost 27. And she was heartbroken because she said he has a good life, you know, to a certain extent. Okay, his condition is deteriorating. He has good friends. He's working part time. But it's really tough to do that. Like, it's, you know, there's no
really
question
tough.
About it.
Yeah, because this was back when I was in my early 20s. So when I heard Elaine speak about Oisin, because her son is 26 now, and I think he was in college or like kind of trying to live his life, trying to get on with things, not have to think about his condition, I'm sure. Obviously, it's part of him. But like, the last thing you want to do is have this broadcast and have it like have news like, say, in December when the NPC rejected or said that it wasn't any value for money. They actually said there's no price at which it can be cost effective, which I was quite surprised about because of the...
Well, what cost on a life? That's the reality. What
no,
cost
it's not
on a
life-saving drug.
I listened carefully to your interview there. It isn't, but it can make a big difference to a person's quality of life.
Of course.
And that's the issue. Now, I would say, we do seem to me to have a minister who is not beholden, the Minister for Health, who is not beholden to bureaucracy and is not afraid of consultants and afraid of pharma companies and the like. And I would have, and I have had hope for a while that she will make a difference. And I think she is, and anyone who's heard her talk, Jennifer Carl McNeil, this is talk about private-public dichotomy in maternity care, would, I think that this is a woman who has patience at heart.
Mm-hmm. But just going back to what you were saying about the toll it takes, is it that the only thing people want to talk to you about, Maria, when you're a patient advocate, is your health condition?
I think that's it. Like, because, like, say, whenever I was a patient advocate, I actually purposely changed my name when I was married and stuff, because I wanted to move away from that and not have that on me as a journalist. I know that sounds very strange.
No, I can understand.
But
that,
I didn't want to be completely labelled with that condition and be like, oh, that's who you are. And that's why, like, I suppose in my head, I was like, oh, that's why people are asking me to, like, say, go on the radio or things like that. So I've never really talked about it. But I think you have all these things and the emotional toil then every time rejection comes from the government or funding comes, like your whole week is kind of distraught, and then you have to pick up yourself and you have to have all this energy to try and campaign, go on the radio and everything while also trying to live your life and get on with things. So it's just huge on families and on patients, and it's not something that people should have to put themselves through again and again, and often for years. Like the campaign that we were involved in went on for 20 years and people died while they were doing it. Like, it was huge. So it's just not something that people should have to give up parts of their life to do.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And we forget, don't we? Because sometimes you think when you hear people on the radio talking, you do accept that it's hard, but you think because you're doing it, you must be robust enough to do it. But that's just a wrong assumption to make, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Like it's very difficult for people. And I suppose whenever I'm interviewing people now on the other side of the mic, I'm always really conscious. And also, like, I learn the language we use around, like, the whole, like, kind of labelling people as their condition and stuff, and not kind of showing what other kind of aspects of their lives are. So, like, it's all this kind of pigeonholing of people and kind of labelling them as, oh, this is what they're doing, this is their life.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is, like, living their life and then taking a break out of their life to try and campaign and to actually live more life. So that's the issue.
All right. Do you want to add something else in there, Lorcan?
I think that's why it's so important that when we're having these discussions that you do keep going back to, like, what is the system and then how do we compare to other similar European countries? So that it's not always on the patient who has to put themselves forward each time. You have to get the system right. And we seem to have a system that is slower and more stringent than our competitive countries.
All right. Well, let's move on now to what Cynthia Ní Maraicheanu, the Fianna Fáil MEP, said on The Hard Shoulder this week about improving road safety. One of the ideas is the introduction introduction of this of AI speed cameras, but there was another for a curfew for novice drivers between 12 at night and 5 o'clock in the morning. Would that make any difference? Who wants to start me off?
Well, I will. I can't get my head around it. On the grounds that traffic is lighter between 12 o'clock and 5 a.m. I think it is anyway, from my own experience driving around. Novice drivers have to get used to driving in the dark. In the winter, it's dark from, you know, 5 p.m. or whatever. So is it to be careful driving in the dark?
It's speed, I think, Gary.
Is it speed?
I imagine the idea is like, that people, you know, when the roads are empty, they speed and then therefore they're crashing.
As we all know, people speed during the daytime. I was driving last week on the toll up towards, the N3 toll. And a chap overtook me as I was slowing down to come to the toll. And I don't know how he didn't hit the barrier. Literally there was a noise of the slamming of brakes, and I was kind of, what is going on?
Was the point of that?
What was the point?
I ask myself that every morning coming into work.
It was just, but like, you know, and I have great admiration for Cynthia Leverick, who I think is a very effective and hardworking MEP. But I mean, and again, is it enforcement? Like, do the guards have enough to do? How would it be enforced? Count me sceptical on it.
Sceptical, Maria?
Yeah, well, I live in Donegal, so this would be extremely difficult to enforce. I think people would just have no social lives because they'd have to get their parents to pick them up at 3 a.m. to go out and stuff like that. I suppose I didn't grow up there. I grew up, actually, I went to the same school as Cynthia Leverick, so I was kind of surprised that, because she's kind of probably would have had to drive into town to go places when she was young and stuff like that. Like, one of the things actually that benefited me was I didn't drink. I was the designated driver when I was in college and stuff. But I suppose, just going back to Donegal, like, there is a huge problem with people dying on the roads. Like, young men in their 20s in counties like Mayo and Donegal are just disproportionately represented in road traffic collisions. That was in the RSA there last month. And Donegal this year has around 10% of road deaths and only 3% of the population. Mm-hmm. So, and like, a lot of those people were in their, like, last month, three people died in their 20s and 30s.
So you're saying something has to be done, but maybe not this?
Yeah, and like, there has been huge talk about this in Donegal, just considering, like, especially last month when there was that weekend, devastating weekend in May. And councillors there are calling for measures like average speed cameras, which I think is a, like, people do slow down, I think, when, well, as far as I know, with the average speed cameras, and also more locally led safety campaigns. So you very rarely would see, like, Donegal County Council, let's say, putting out a safety campaign about certain areas or certain roads, or trying to call people to slow down, or even school led campaigns and things like
that.
The
average speed camera idea, I think, is one that really does affect how you drive, doesn't it?
Technology should be used massively on this for enforcement, I think, is the real answer. I don't think we need another new law. I think we need to enforce the ones that are there and use technology, because we're not going to get the level of guards that we used to have. We're not going, like, that doesn't seem to happen. So the idea of average cameras, AI cameras, etc., does make sense. I also think the idea of targeting specific cohorts like novice drivers is probably the right one, maybe in a slightly different way, where we should have data. We don't have good enough data, but we should have the data that says, well, we know who causes the vast majority of accidents. We know who's involved in the vast majority of accidents. You can do it by gender in particular. Mm. You can do it by age. And therefore, targeted approaches, I think, make sense. I would not be against if you're a novice.
I see going wild on the roads in the morning very early don't have an N on the back. Do you know?
Yeah. But you could do targeted things on novices around, you know, like speed checks within the car and things like that. I mean, the technology is there to
now,
do that.
I'm nearly at the end, but I want to know who's going to go to the Katie Taylor fight in September. I'm going. Cards on the table. I'll be there 5th of September. She's an absolute hero. Gary is not going.
I'm going to watch Cork on Sunday in the Munster final. I'm a big team sports fan, Claire. And I think Katie Taylor is an extraordinary sportswoman and has been an extraordinary ambassador for Ireland. And it is an unusual fight because it's the final fight, and I tend to think it'll be more of an event than a championship bout.
It's a tribute to her, celebration of her.
And good luck to her.
You
and
come with me, I'll
team.
Bring you.
I'd be happy to go with you, Claire, of course. You can introduce me to the finer arts of the old tradition.
It's one of those ones for me where I have no huge interest in boxing.
I don't either, but I just think we should go for Katie.
I feel like if it wasn't going to sell out, I'd be more likely to go. Do you know, if there's one of the same, oh my God, it's not going to sell out, Katie deserves this, therefore I'd be more willing to go. Would I fight somebody for a ticket? No.
Right, that's the three of us are going. Are you coming with us, Maria?
I think, like, I just really remember the 2012 Olympics. It was just such a monumental moment for Ireland. And I think Katie Taylor has made the ability of women to have boxing careers. And I think as a woman who likes sport, I have to go.
All right, we're going.
It's a family event they want it to be. That's the important point. It's not just tickets for individuals. And of course, boxing has had a very bad reputation over the last few years. I wish her luck and I hope she does fill it out.
Right. Well, listen, the announcement is coming up, we think, at 2 o'clock today. So we look forward to that. We have to leave it there. Thank you all very much indeed for being with us. And my thanks to everybody who got in touch with the programme today. And indeed, over the course of the week, if there's anything you missed, you can go back and listen on the Go Loud app. And if you do happen to be listening to the highlights from the show over the weekend, please do check out the first episode of Never Have I Ever, with thanks to O'Brien's Wines. That's my brand new podcast. I met best-selling author Katrina O'Sullivan this week, who explained to me exactly what it takes to write a book. Just search for Never Have I Ever on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, the team, and huge thanks to Cormac McDonough on sound, producers Alex Russo, Helene O'Toole and Dee King, research by David O'Connor. Our broadcast assistant is Anne-Marie King.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.